Red light, green light.
Judges, if you want to go ahead and be turning in your Bibles there. And normally we are kind of talk about how Deborah is the judge. And certainly going to test that a little bit this evening. Judge is kind of more the idea of a deliverer of the people. And Deborah is kind of an official judge, right? She judges the cases of people, kind of more like we use the term today. And she is a prophetess and basically tells Barak, and he is the one that really delivers the people. But I guess in the song, it just kind of fits Deborah better than Barak, right? Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Deborah instead of Shamgar, Barak. But anyway, so we'll get that this evening. And these two chapters, so chapter 4 kind of tells the story of God delivering his people from Sisera and from Jabin, the king of Canaan. And then chapter 5 is more of a song, right? It's a poem and talking about what God did in chapter 4. So I'll just kind of jog your memory. What do these chapters remind you of previously in the Old Testament? Kind of a chapter with a story followed by a chapter with a song about that story. Red Sea. Good. So Exodus 14 and then 15. So we get Exodus 15 is the song of Miriam, right? And rejoicing and praising God for saving them from the Egyptians, from slavery. So that's kind of what we have here as well. This is kind of the Exodus 14 and 15 of Judges, if you will. So that's what we're going to be looking at. I thought just kind of way of review, we'll just kind of look at this cycle that we're just going to see again and again in this book. And this is kind of the third time that we have seen this. We saw it with Othniel, we saw it with Ehud, Shamgar got one verse, but will be mentioned in chapter 5. The Lord, they serve the Lord for a time, and then they fall into sin. And then God gives them over to an enemy nation, to an enemy king, and then they are oppressed, and oppressed to the point to where they finally cry out to the Lord. The Lord sends a judge or a deliverer for them, and then they are delivered, and they enjoy a time of peace, and then this just repeats itself. They never learn the lesson, right? They just keep going in this vicious cycle, and this cycle just goes like this, right, on the screen. If it were 3D, I would say it just kind of spirals down. Each cycle just gets worse and worse. And even the judge or the deliverer, we see a decline in his morality and his maybe dedication to the Lord, where we end up with Samson, kind of the worst of them all. So what's that?
Most famous.
Most famous. Yes. Probably so, with all the muscles and all that. But so we have kind of the first one. I'm so glad this is working. Good idea, Alan. I'm giving Alan all the credit. When I put it in that little hole, it doesn't work. So thank you, Alan. So first we started with Othniel. And I'm just kind of giving you just kind of what happened there. That guy, Mesopotamia, was the enemy, and they served for 8 years. And Othniel, remember, related to Caleb, and just did a great job of leading the people. Great man of character that we saw in chapter 1. They enjoyed 40 years of peace. Then we saw Ehud defeat Eglon, fat guy, right, of Moab. And he was able to kill him, flee the palace, and lead the troops in defeating Moab. And then they enjoyed 80 years of peace after 18 years of slavery, and we'll see that number keep going up. Shamgar, we just know he defeated the Philistines at the end of chapter 3. I'll go ahead and give you Deborah. And again, we are kind of looking at Canaan, and you just see that years of slavery keep increasing, right? And the years of peace is, again, back to 40. But that's kind of the, maybe some things to look at as we continue through this book. In verses 1 through 3, I just want to point out kind of the beginning of this cycle. Repeats itself again that we saw at the beginning. So you see the sons of Israel doing evil in the sight of the Lord. Everything is good up until they start disobeying the Lord. And we learn a little bit more about some of these things that happen in chapter 4. We learn a little bit more in chapter 5, giving a little bit more of the details, right, in the Song of Deborah. We learn there that they go after other gods, they choose other gods to serve, which probably guess that, looking at chapter 2. And so God never allows them to be under an enemy nation before they sin against him. And I think that's a key point, because if that were to happen, then you would come to the conclusion of, well, we're just not, this other nation is stronger than we are, and we just don't have a chance against them. God never allowed that until they disobeyed. And as soon as they disobeyed, the Lord sold them into slavery. In this case, it was Jabin, king of Canaan, and he reigned in Hazor. Now, Hazor is a city that is located just north of the Sea of Galilee. So if you kind of picture Canaan, got Dead Sea, Jordan River, Sea of Galilee, and then north of that, just on the west side, would be Hazor. So that's where he is. And the commander of the army, of his army, is Sisera. And then they cry out to the Lord, because here we have these iron chariots again. This is the very last time that I saw in the Bible that it mentions iron and of an army having iron chariots. And maybe it's because of what happens in this story. So I just thought that unique, because iron chariots have been kind of Israel's downfall, starting back in Joshua. Remember Joshua, I'll just reference this. In Joshua chapter 17, the tribe of Joseph kind of complaining and saying, man, you didn't give us near enough land, and there, we are numerous. We're a large tribe. And he said, well, you have enough land. It just, there's some hill country, and you just need to plow and knock over some trees, and you can have that. I said, well, there's a valley, and they have some iron chariots. And Joshua tells them, don't be afraid of the iron chariot. So from the beginning, you see that in Joseph, and then in Judges chapter 1, verse 19, it was Judah who did so well for 18 verses. And then you come to 19, so they couldn't take care of this group because of the iron chariots. So now we have Jabin, Sisera. Not only does he have an iron chariot, he has 900 of them, which is an enormous amount. So again, you see them focused on, they have iron chariots, so there's no way we can win, right? So you see their lack of faith in the Lord that he can take care of these iron chariots. So because they have iron chariots, they are crying out to the Lord. And notice the text says, I believe they're in verse 3, that Israel was, or he oppressed the sons of Israel severely for 20 years. That there's an adjective there, severely, and that's missing from all the other two accounts, from Othniel and Ehud. So maybe this was an even more deeper oppression that God is allowing his people to go through, because this is the third time. This is the third time that they have said, I'm not going to serve the Lord. I'm going to go after these other gods. You'd think they would learn. You're just not learning. I'm going to really teach you a lesson. And so he allows them to be severely oppressed. And again, you saw that 20 years. You just see God's frustration with them growing. So then we're going to be introduced to Deborah, and we'll get the story of deliverance, starting in chapter 4 through the end of the chapter. Any comments or thoughts before we get going with this story? So starting in verse 4, we are introduced to Deborah. And Deborah was a prophetess, and I believe there are five prophetesses in the Bible. Do you remember an earlier woman who was a prophetess before Deborah? And we already mentioned her. Good. It was Miriam was a prophetess, the sister of Moses and Aaron, and she, along with Deborah, did that song, right? In chapter, so there's a lot of maybe connections there, similarities between Deborah and Miriam. And so what is a prophetess? What does that mean? Or what is a prophet? Be the male version, right?
A messenger of God.
Good. A messenger or maybe a mouthpiece of the Lord. It's just someone who God speaks to and then they speak God's message to the people. So she is judging Israel, and she would pass judgment for the people. And she sat under a palm tree between Ramah and Bethel. Now that is located about 12 miles directly west of Jericho. So if you kind of figure out where Jericho is, not a little bit above the Dead Sea, and just go 12 miles over to the left, and that's kind of the region of where she is, or where she was doing this. And so she has a message to Barak in verses 6 and 7. So she sends for Barak, summons him, and so he seems to come down to her. And he starts out by saying, "The Lord has commanded you." And so this is a direct command that God is giving you. He says, "Take 10,000 men from Naphtali and Zebulun." And this is not 10,000 each, just 10,000 total, as we learn in verse 10. But you think about, if you have a map in your Bible of the tribes of Israel, Zebulun and Naphtali would be located where? Yeah, north, which would be close to Hazor, right? So that would be the area in which Hazor is going to come first. So these northern tribes, I want you to get 10,000 men, and then I want you to go to Mount Tabor. And then God says, "I will draw out Sisera and his iron chariots to the river Kishon, and then I will give them into your hands." I want us to think about this for a moment, because it's very important. Where would the iron chariots be the most destructive? In what kind of territory?
Plain.
Not mountainous. Where is God telling his army to go?
River back.
Yeah. Down towards the river, which would be a plain area, which would give who the advantage?
You'd think.
Without the Lord, it would definitely give Sisera and those 900 chariots of his a great advantage. And God says, "Look, I don't want to defeat them in a mountain where they're not going to be as powerful. So I want you to go down to them where they have all the advantages in the world, to win this battle. That's what God, that's where God shines the brightest. And in verse 8, how does Barak respond to this command from the Lord? You come with me. I'm not going to go unless you come as well. What do you think about that?
Maybe he didn't really trust in what she was saying. So if she goes with me, then this is for real.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, if he thought the Lord was with her and that, you know, he had seen some of the things that she maybe said were going to happen. And she obviously was very smart. So I don't put it all on, you know, bad on him. He may have been really pretty smart asking her.
Okay. Ms. Glenda, okay.
I don't know. I tend to think he was just a coward. The Holman Bible uses back in verse 6, when when Deborah is talking to Barak, says, "Hasn't the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you to do this?" And if that is a correct translation, she's just repeating what he had already heard. And if he'd already heard it, and now he doesn't want to go unless she goes with him, that's cowardice. I mean, I don't know any way around that.
Good point.
I don't know what other versions say about that.
Yeah, I do have a footnote in New American Standard. It does, has not the Lord commanded. So that seems to be the more literal translation of that. I agree. I think this is, if the Lord tells you this is what you need to do, should our response be, I'm not going to do it unless you come with me. That's not great on our end, right, if we have that kind of attitude. I agree. He believes the Lord is with you, so if you come with me, then I'll have the Lord. Maybe that's kind of his thought process. But if the Lord tells us to do something, it's yes, sir, and right away, right? So that's his response. Deborah slash God response, since God's talking through her, said, okay, I'll go with you, but you are no longer going to receive the glory of this battle. That glory is going to belong to a woman, which they were not allowed to have a woman soldier. So how in the world, right, is a woman going to receive the glory for this battle? So you just kind of, man, how is the Lord going to do this? And so that kind of maybe piques your interest right at the beginning. So Deborah and Barak go to Kedesh and gather 10,000 men, and we'll get a little bit more of who those 10,000 men are in chapter 5, but mostly probably Naphtali and Zebulun. They're going up north, got those men on Mount Tabor, ready to do some work. So we'll have kind of a little side note here in verse 11. But any comments or thoughts, just kind of through verse 10? Now, I may need to speed up, so I'm just going to keep going. I'll ask you, and then I'll tell you you can't comment. That's how it's going to be tonight. So verse 11, we have the Kenite. And doesn't this verse seem out of place? Like, well, why in the world are we, who cares about where he went, how he left the other Kenites? Remember, they first settled in Jericho, the city of the palms. And then in chapter 1, verse 16 of Judges, they migrated south to live with people of Judah and in the wilderness south of Arad. And so he decides, I'm going to live near Kedesh. So that kind of puts him right close in the vicinity of where this battle is going to take place and where this army, 10,000-man army of Israel, is. So that he's going to come up later, obviously, in verses 17 through 22. But God gives the victory over Sisera's army, which of course includes his 900 chariots. So Sisera hears of Barak's army, and in verses 12 and 13, he is taking off full force. Remember, this seems to be 20 years from the point that they were first enslaved. So this is maybe near the end of that 20 years. Think about that. I'm not positive on that. But several years have passed, and all right, I'm just going to take care of these rebels. I'm going to bring 900 iron chariots, and we'll just take care of this right away. Israel goes down from Mount Tabor to fight in verse 14. And Deborah tells Barak, now's the time. And notice her emphasis there in verse 14. The Lord Yahweh has given Sisera into your hands. Yahweh has gone out before you. So who's doing the work? Obviously, it's the Lord. It's the Lord through Barak that is doing this. But great encouragement. It's your time. But remember, the Lord is the one that's doing this. Barak, to his credit, leads the charge of 10,000 men. Now, what do you think of Barak here? Why I ask this is because in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 32, it says, time will fail me if I tell you of Gideon, Barak, and Samson. This took a lot of courage, took a lot of guts to do what he did, to go down this mountain, to face not only 900 chariots, but remember he also brought his army with him, many troops with him that they are having to fight. Let's see if I can find it really quick. Maybe I'll get to it later on. We learn in Judges 5, Israel was not very equipped as far as weaponry goes. So this takes a great amount of faith for Barak to do this. Okay, the Lord's with me, I'm going. In verse 15 and 16, it says, the Lord routed Sisera. He destroyed his chariots and his army with the edge of the sword. And so you have Sisera and his army in their best case scenario in the plains with the chariots, and God still destroys them. So Sisera, notice, he flees from his chariot and fled away on foot. Does that seem odd to you? Why would you get off your chariot and flee on foot? You would think your chariot could go a little bit faster than your feet. Josh?
I'm thinking since they're by a river, that this river is probably in the flood stage, so the chariot probably got stuck. So
I think
you can get on foot faster than trying to get this chariot out of the mud.
I think you're right.
Look at chapter 5. In verse 21 and 22, we're given a little bit more details. The torrent of Kishon swept them away, the ancient torrent. The torrent of Kishon, oh my soul, march on with strength. Then the horse's hoofs beat from the dashing and the dashing of his valiant steeds. And we know this also from a psalm as well. I'm prone to think that this was not kind of the time that it normally flooded. God did that. And so here's the time, it's fine, it's very dry, but God sends down the rain, floods the entire plain there by the Kishon River, and then what do you know about an iron chariot? Probably pretty heavy, right? So the more it's in the mud, just the slower and slower, and just kind of you're there, stuck in the mud, not able to do anything. So their greatest asset became their greatest liability. See what God did? You just bring them down to the river, and I'll take care of them there. Yes, sir?
I think it's even worse than that. 4, 5, and 6 says is that the earth trembled and the heavens dropped. Yes, the clouds dropped water. And in 6 it says, in the days of Shamgar, the days of Jael, the highways were abandoned and travelers kept to the byways. Brother Hook was probably old enough to have driven on a dirt road when it's really raining and it just turns to mud. Sometimes you just have to get off the road because it's more firm over in the pasture. And I think that the entire army bogged down right there. And God fought it like he would send hornets before. Well, he sent the rain too. It's really kind of interesting. Yeah, they thought they were going to have the advantage, but
Yeah, I think that's the idea. They thought they were going to have the advantage. They didn't. We'll jump into chapter 5 in a moment. But it's powerful how God can just change everything to his advantage when Sisera thinks this is going to be cakewalk, right? These Israelites who think they're going to win. So Sisera flees from his army, which a great leader should do, right? Here's your army. I'm going to run the other way. Flee for my own life. So that's what he does, and Barak pursues the army, and notice, verse 16, not even one was left. Total victory from the Lord, and it is certainly the Lord's doing, right? The Lord is with you. The Lord's going to deliver you. Barak has the faith to do that. He doesn't know exactly how that's going to happen, but he does, and the Lord delivers. Verses 17 to 22, it's talking about the death of Sisera. So Sisera flees to the house of Heber, that guy again, that we saw in chapter verse 11. And there was peace between them, so he decided this is a safe place. And now you see God fulfilling his promise that he made back in verse 9. The woman's going to get the glory from this and not a man. So God is fulfilling that promise, and Jael, Heber's wife, persuades Sisera, come in the house, I'll take care of you, and then puts a covering over, or kind of a blanket over him. Can you give me some water? So I'll give you some milk. And I've tossed a little bit about that. Is that a you want water? That would be really refreshing. I'm just going to give you milk instead. Is it kind of a jab at him, or is this a I'll do something even better than water? Maybe the idea of milk will put him to sleep. I think I thought of that. So some value thought to that. If this were, and this is, I don't have a good answer, so I'll just tell you what's on my mind. You can figure it out. If you are Jael and you have a plan in your head that you are going to kill this guy, would you want to do anything that would cause him to kind of be alarmed that you're not on his side? And that would be, I think, a decent argument to say, well, I'll give you even better than what? I'll give you milk. And we learn in chapter 5 from a nice, kind of in the poetic, with a nice jar, nice way of doing that for him. So I don't know. It could be either way. I don't have a great, I'm not sold on either one of those. So that's what happens. Yes, sir.
Verse 11, he like abandons his tribe and goes off and lives by himself. And then verse 17, he's allied with the main bad guy.
Yeah.
So he's clearly not on good terms with the rest of Israel.
Yeah, good point. Good point. So you have his wife kind of taking him in, and Sisera's last words, if anyone comes, just tell them nobody's here. And after that, he feels safe enough or exhausted enough to go to sleep. And as he is sound asleep, Jael makes sure he stays that way and puts something right through his head to the ground. And I love, where is it? This is really helpful to me. Verse 21, at the very end, to leave no doubt, so he died. So there, he could have recovered, but the text did say he died right there. So kind of the understatement, right? So
in fact, he left the tent peg in his head.
Yeah, there's to the ground. So he died. So Barak comes by and jails. All right, let me show you Sisera. And God shows Barak he kept his promise that he would sell Sisera into the hands of a woman. Barak maybe did not get the pleasure of killing this leader, this great military leader. That was done by Jael. And then 23 and 24, I think a good note talks good of Israel here, where Israel just kept the foot on the gas. And even though we beat these 900 chariots, even though we beat mighty Sisera, we kept pursuing Jabin until finally he died, and we won that battle as well. So it took time, but they kept on pursuing and finally won that battle. Notice verse 23, so God subdued on that day Jabin, the king of Canaan, before sons of Israel. How many times is it emphasized in this chapter, this is what God is doing. This is God's work. It was really helpful, and I'll make one point, and then we'll try to get to this wonderful poem, chapter 5. Then we can go two different ways, two different extremes, in thinking about, well, all I have to do is let God do everything, and I can sit back and relax. I'll pray for wisdom like the Bible says, and then God will, I guess, just zap me with wisdom, and I'll be wise one day and just keep praying that until it happens. So I'll just sit back and let God do all the work. Or, man, God's not going to do anything, so I need to do everything. You can see how both of those are kind of the two ditches on each side of the road. Where did God win the battle? For sure, right? It's emphasized again and again. But did Barak have to swing the sword? Did Barak have to lead the army? Did men have to work in order to do? Well, sure. And I think it's the same thing as today. If we want to grow in our wisdom, well, we need to ask the Lord, and we need to be reading the Bible and growing in the wisdom of the Word. Paul prayed for the Ephesians. I want you to grow in the knowledge of the Word. If we want to bring the lost to Christ, does Jesus say you need to pray for that? He sure does, right? Does that mean we just pray for it and we just look around and just can't wait for that to happen? Can't wait for God to do that? No, it takes some part on us as well. I think this chapter, this story, really, really emphasizes that point. I'm going to go on. There's just so much to cover in chapter 5. I think it adds a lot of great stuff to the story that we covered. So look at the introduction here, and we'll look at verse 1, kind of the introduction to the psalm. Or song, what would you say, what are some advantages to having a song about a story that we just read about? What would be the advantage to them to have a song? How would you answer that?
Yeah, people would be more likely to remember.
Yeah. For me, it's a lot easier if something is in a rhyme or a beat or I can remember it better, put it to a song than maybe just kind of reading about it. So songs can stir you up, right? Emotions can do that. You're gonna.
It's a good way to help spread the word too.
Absolutely. Yeah, I imagine this song was well known. Through Israel. It's written down for us here. So there's great blessings of a song. And notice what they did. They sang on that day. What do you appreciate about that? That they sang it on that day. I think referring to the day that Sisera died and they routed and destroyed this army. What's good? Yeah, they were immediately thankful for what God had done. And they recognized this is what God has done. We need to immediately thank him. How many times has God blessed us and done such good things for us, and we just kind of move on without giving him thanks? So they said, man, this is such an amazing story of how God delivered us. Not only do we need to say thank you, we need to write this down so that other people can be thankful, so that other people can learn just how wonderful God is. So they desired for many to sing and think about the message of this song. So really quickly, with the little bit of time we have left, notice verse 2, that the leaders led in Israel, that the people volunteered, bless the Lord. I just kind of noted, everyone did their part. Everyone had a role to play. You needed Barak. You needed those leaders to lead the charge. We're running down the mountain. We're going to take them. Don't know how, but we're going to do it. The Lord is with us. The leaders led, and the volunteers, all those who signed up to be a part of that 10,000-man army, said, all right, I'm right behind you. And so the people volunteered, but then who made it all happen? Bless, not the leaders, not bless the bless the Lord, right? He is the one that demands all the praise. And so in verses 3 through 11, we'll try to go through this pretty quickly, and we'll hopefully have some time for comments. I won't talk the whole time. But verses 3 through 11, you have Israel, kind of the beginnings of Israel. You have them being exalted as a nation, to be a nation. And notice verse 3, this is a song, hear, O kings, give ear, O rulers. I believe that's not talking about the kings in Israel, because there are no kings. That's talking to the nations. This song is not just for Israel, this is for all the nations to understand who the great God of heaven is. So this song is for everyone. And then verses 4 and 5, you have the picture of Mount Sinai, of kind of when God came on that mountain and it's quaking and it's thundering, it's lightning, and you have this huge thing. And then you have the idea of when you march, verse 4, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the field of Edom. If you look at Deuteronomy 33 and in verse 2, it's the same, almost the same picture there, kind of referencing Mount Sinai. So I think both of these are kind of encapsulating, looking at that scene in Mount Sinai. And so look what God has done. He's made this great nation. He's the powerful God. And then look what happens starting in verse 6. And then Israel falls apart. So you have in the days of Shamgar, that recent history, right? Last verse of chapter 3. In the days of Shamgar, in the days of Jael. So that's, of course, the one who killed Sisera. Now let's look at modern time Israel. How's Israel doing at the present time is kind of the idea. And it says new gods were chosen. Verse 8 was the verse I was trying to find. New gods were chosen, then war was in the gates. Not a shield or a spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. Now, I don't know. I can't know. But I'm guessing that 10,000-man army didn't have much shields or spears or swords on hand because they were enslaved. Why in the world would a nation allow you to have this great supply of things that could kill them? So it gives you even more credit or just appreciation for those volunteers in what they did. And then God turns things around starting in verse 9 and 11. Notice the parallels to verse 9 and verse 2. My heart goes out to the commanders or the leaders, the volunteers among the people, bless the Lord. So that kind of nice little bracketed section there. So again, this is kind of the beginning, the introduction to this song. This is what God did for us. This is how we declined so rapidly, and we had nothing to fight with. But man, I'm so thankful for those commanders, so thankful for those volunteers, and bless the Lord. He's the one that deserves all the credit. So it's a call for everyone to listen, to see what God has done. So verse 12 to 21 is, or 23, excuse me, is the idea of God winning the battle. Look at verse 12 through 15, kind of 15a. The latter part of 15 is another section. It's talking about all those volunteers, all those people who, when called out, said, we need you to fight these 900 iron chariots. We need you to go to war. The Lord has called us to battle. They said, we're in. We'll go. Even though we don't have much to fight with, we will help in whatever way we can. So verse 12, awake, Deborah, awake, Barak. It's a call to action. And they are going, and you see Ephraim and Benjamin, Zebulun, Issachar, and then kind of the latter part of verse 15, those in Reuben and those in Gilead remained. Why did Dan stay in the ship? That's a shocker, right? Dan's not willing to help. Not much of a shock at all. But you see, there's some that said, I will go. I will trust in the Lord. Where others said, I'm going to stay behind. I'm out on this one. Yes, ma'am.
Good.
Great point. So in Joshua, they were afraid of the chariots, and now you see them rising up and doing that. Great. Good. I didn't see that. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question.
Okay.
When we go back into chapter 4, we're looking at the end of verse 6, when Deborah's talking to Barak, she says, didn't God tell you to take 10,000 men from the Naphtalites and Zebulunites?
Right.
So now we're over here, and it looks like they're being criticized for not volunteering, but it doesn't look like God intended for them. It doesn't look like that was Barak's instructions. Am I missing something?
So I think Issachar and Zebulun did join, and how I see it, and I could be wrong, I see it as other people wanted to be involved in this battle as well, and I guess Barak said, You're free to join. You're a volunteer. You can come join the army. That's how I see it, but I could be wrong in that. So we have these people who join, some who don't. And then verse 19 to 23, we covered a little bit on how God gains the victory. I'm out of time. So he wins the victory, and then 24 through 30 kind of details the victory over Sisera, talks about jail and the death of Sisera. And then 28 to 30, this song is talking about who? Who is the main subject in 28 to 30? Yeah. Sisera's mother. And she's expecting this great, wonderful victory, and she is mourning and everything. And then verse 31 is the call for God's people. I love this verse. Thus let all your enemies perish, O Lord, but let those who love him be like the rising sun in its might. So may we be those who love the Lord, and the Lord will do great things with us. I wish we had more time. Just keep going. But bell has rung. I know that's when I stop. So thank you for good participation. We'll, Lord willing, look at Gideon next. Thank you.